The prohibition of cannabis forced us to focus on its tetrahydrocannabinol. Now that the prohibition appears to be fizzling out, we pause to ask, is there anything else in cannabis with which we might get high?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1276th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Yokosuka who are tuned into the podcast as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, the cannabis plant traveled with us throughout time as a good and faithful servant. It provided us a strong fiber with which we could hold things together, clothe ourselves, and sail across the oceans. It gave us seeds rich in the precious fats that we needed to build a bigger brain. And it provided us with a chemical that gave us the ability to laugh off that which we needed to laugh off. Then in very recent times, it provided us with something to prohibit when we needed to prohibit something. This prohibition forced us to focus on the cannabis plant's chemical tetrahydrocannabinol to the exclusion of all the other good things our faithful servant gave us throughout time. In the minds of many, if not most, the prohibition of cannabis is simply fizzling out. Those who want to get high on tetrahydrocannabinol may do so without fear of going to jail, even where cannabis is still illegal. But as cannabis grows in acceptance, it's losing its sense of excitement. And that leads us to ask, is there anything else in cannabis with which we might get high on possibilities? Who better to ask than Mike Keller, who is the managing partner of New Progress Farms. Mike, what do you think? Is there something else in cannabis other than that intoxicant tetrahydrocannabinol?
There's a much bigger world than the licensed market for THC and then the other cannabinoids, CBD, CBG, CBN, and so on.
And it's all waiting for there for us to rediscover, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's but until the passage of the 2018 Farm Bill, you know, it was highly regulated to even to grow small test crops. But now the gloves are off, the restraints are off. And so the farmers are discovering these crops to grow and then also wait, you know, the different products that they can turn them into.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, you've been in this business for a long time. The last time we worked together, my goodness, was way back in, Food Chain number 705 and 743. That's almost 500 food chains ago, long time ago. What made you focus in on cannabis the way you have?
First of all, I guess the market is just much, much bigger. You know, THC, you have a certain percentage of the population that would be willing to try it. You get into minor cannabinoids and there's, you know, different products that you can buy and there's, you know, healthcare and that type of thing. But when you look at industrial hemp and the possibilities, you can make clothes out of industrial hemp. You can make food products out of industrial hemp. And you can make, you know, dwellings, you know, home, you know, building products out of industrial hemp. So, you know, food, clothing, and shelter, all from one plant. And that touches everyone on the planet that you can do that. And it grows in 120 days and requires very little inputs in terms of fertilizers, pesticides, fungicides, and that type of thing.
Now, what really captured my attention was your notice that you were going to be growing in Bakersfield area of California, yes. Great Central Valley. Yeah. And what captured my attention about that was that I always thought that would be the perfect place to grow cannabis. And it grew elsewhere, mostly because, you know, for example, it grew up in Mendocino County and Humboldt County because you could hide it in the trees there. But sure. Bakersfield, hot, dry, flat. Wow. So you can really go to town there, correct?
Yeah. And a couple of years ago, it was pretty funny. We were growing a CBD crop for extraction. And we're out near Arvin, you know, east of Bakersfield, up near Big Bear Mountain there. And, you know, and these are small plants in stature, the structure of them that look like little Christmas trees. And you know, one evening, a truckload of farm workers showed up, got out of the truck and started pulling plants out of the ground thinking they were marijuana. And even though, you know, you could smoke the whole field and not catch a buzz, but it was, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding about it, but to your point, it's, you know, California leads the world in food production. Kern County, where Bakersfield is, leads California in food production. So you can grow pretty much anything you want to in Kern County in Bakersfield. It's perfect.
So long as you have water, you can.
Yeah, as long as you have water, that's a very good point.
Well, yeah, hot, dry environments perfect for cannabis, which does not like a lot of moisture, as you find near the close coast. So mm-hmm. let's talk a little bit about the cannabis plant as a crop. Of course, we were well aware of its intoxicating properties, and now that it's legal, we're starting to see, you know, the plant grown for its intoxicating properties outside even. But that's not really where we're going to go today. We're going to talk about the other uses, which include the medicinal properties. But you bring up the whole notion of an industry. And that's kind of an amazing way of looking at it, because that's the way it always was before Prohibition, correct?
Mm-hmm. Right. The founding fathers grew hemp. It was actually... what I'm told, it was sort of a regulation that the early settlers in the original colonies were required to grow hemp for fiber production to be made into clothing and also to produce food, you know, for farm animals and also for the families. Thomas Jefferson was an industrial hemp grower, and so I'm not sure who else, but there was, you know,
George Washington. Yep. Yeah. So all of the founding fathers were.
Yeah. And, you know, it was easy to grow. You know, you threw the seeds in the ground and 100 days, 120 days later, you had a crop. You come along, you cut it off at the ground. You stand the stalks up to let them dry in the sun, or wet, as they call it. And then the material that holds the fibers on the outside begins to recede. You can strip the fibers off and treat them further to make clothing, very durable clothing, much more durable than denim is. Mm-hmm. And then the middle of the crop, the middle of the stalk was heard, which is very absorbent. They use it for animal bedding. And then the seeds, or they would hold them. Those are the hearts, very high in omega-3s and 6s, and protein. So it was an excellent source of protein and nutrition, you know, for the settlers and for animals too. So it's none of the plant went to waste.
And yet, because of Prohibition, all of those other uses kind of fell by the wayside for its one intoxicating property. So in a very real sense, it's been one of history's greatest wastes, that Prohibition laid upon our heads.
Yeah, they tarred industrial hemp with the same brush as they did, you know, its psychoactive cousin. And even though, it thwarted all research, you know, so in effect, Europe, especially Eastern European countries and Italy, you know, they made us some really great materials made from, you know, hemp textile fiber. You know, the different processing technologies out of the Netherlands, Poland, Spain, you know, they really were light years ahead of us. Canada too, you know, but not as much as in Europe. So now we're playing catch up, and it's really exciting to watch the different technologies as they emerge. It seems like every day I learn of a new process that just blows my mind, and it's very exciting.
So let's back up a little bit. Now, we start with a basic fundamental cannabis plant, of which there are, I think, three different species, correct? Three different varieties. Mm-hmm. There's sativa, indica, and ruderalis. Now, I think all of them contain the tetrahydro THC, the tetrahydrocannabinol, some to a greater extent than others. Now, when you go to grow for industrial purposes, what do you use?
Well, the we go to, just like any other crop, you're going to grow a variety that does well, in our case, and the desert, sandy loma, very loose soil, and so we, honestly, there's zero consideration given to sativa indica, the third one. But we're looking for something that, this is a fast growing crop. You're going to use it for, for biomass. So you're going to use, you're going to grind up the whole plant and use it as a, or you're going to take the fiber and make rope out of it. You're going to take the fiber and make, non-woven textiles. It really depends on what the end use is. There are farmers that just grow for the grains. So they'll grow a very short stature crop that they, they'll take the, they use it as a food product or an ingredient in, these plant-based meats is what I'm seeing now. And it just really depends on what the end product is. Mm-hmm. But most of these varieties are coming from Europe, and where, to a lesser extent, Canada, and even a lesser extent than Asia. But it just depends on what the end product is. But most of them are coming out of Europe.
Now, with respect to its... the amount of THC that it is allowed to contain, I think the government is fairly strict on that. Is that not true?
Oh yeah, and so when you're going, and this was what a lot of people got into trouble with, and there were some really heartbreaking stories to tell. So you're going for CBD, the second most common cannabinoid in hemp, next to THC in marijuana. You would grow it, and to get the best market price, you had to have the highest percentage of CBD in it. They would measure it just like THC. So 17%, 20%, 30%, and so on. But the longer you let it grow, the longer you let it stand in the field, the percentages of all of the cannabinoids would kind of increase, at the same time. And the careless farmers, or farmers that bought a, genetics that were not very unscrupulous buyers, it would get hot. And let's say you had 100 acres and the police come out, or the regulators come out, and they do a field test, and you're above the 0.3% limit. And they make your disc get under.
And you've lost your crop.
Ridiculous.
Right?
Yeah.
Just like that. Wow.
And so you really had to kind of plan. You had to watch it on a day-by-day basis, saying, by the time I get it all off the field, it's going to be,
something else,
by 3%. And then even after you cut it down and bale it and take it to the processing center, then, it continues to, the percentages will increase then. And they can even show you that, oh my God, it's now 0.35. It's now legally marijuana.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, Mike. When we come back, we're going to pick this up. Cannabis, something else to get high other than the tetrahydrocannabinol. Right back with Mike Eller. Well, folks, it is a crop that has been with us throughout time. I think way back when we first started keeping track of things, we noted that a group of people called the Scythians were throwing the seeds on the fire and enjoying the intoxicating properties thereof. But if you think about it, it's been such a wonderful crop for us. It's given us clothes. It's given us good essential fats, food, protein. It's provided sales. We sailed around the world with it. And yet we made it illegal. And in making it illegal, we forced ourselves to focus only on that intoxicating chemical, tetrahydrocannabinol. And now we're thinking maybe it's time to start looking elsewhere, as is Mike Keller, who is the managing partner of New Progress Farms. So tell us about New Progress Farms. What are you going to be doing and growing?
We're professional farmers, commercial scale farmers that provide, contract mechanical services for, everyday row crops and high value crops, row crops like processed tomatoes or grapes, processed tomatoes, cotton, beets, carrots, that type of thing, potatoes. And then we do field work for high value crops like, almonds or, table grapes, wine grapes, that type of thing.
So you're working with some pros here.
California agriculture is the most extreme or most efficient operation of any agricultural operation in the world. You have crews that come in, all they do is field prep, they put in irrigation systems, they'll plant for you, they'll harvest for you, they'll bring the agronomist. So a farmer these days a lot of times never even sits on a tractor or gets his hands dirty.
That's a very interesting point, Mike, because people often think, well, farmer is somebody out there in the field with a shovel, and not necessarily so anymore. Farmers are often more like contractors.
That's right. It's like building a subdivision, where the basement guys come in, and then the framers come in, the plumbers come in, the electricians. Everybody has their job. And then what's even more important is because of where California is, we have an indigenous population. We have a permanent population of farm workers that are highly skilled, many of them from Mexico, but they know they can count on work. They don't have to drift with the harvest. They're in one place, and these crews work together. They're very skilled. They make good livings. And it's a very vibrant scene, and that is unmatched anywhere else in the world.
We had the opportunity actually to drive through the Central Valley just yesterday, and through the Salinas Valley as well, and saw a lot of farm workers out in the fields, and we saw their cars, and they're driving some nice cars.
Yeah. So the crops you probably saw, certainly berries, they'll come in and they'll pick the, like the strawberries and things. And these it's grueling work to do what they're doing, where they're harvesting berries and whatnot. But, a good picker can make, $300 a day, but these are guys they're working their hoofies off.
Yep. And they're much better.
I have respect for them.
And they're much better at it than I am. I'll guarantee you that.
Yeah. And so I have nothing but respect for those people. They are the hardest working people on the planet, and I really admire them.
So on the New Progress Farm, what kind of products are you going to be shooting for with respect to cannabis?
It's a great question. So there's the plant has got three parts essentially. There's a fibrous outer part that goes into making textiles or, ropes or something like that.
And with respect to that, it would seem like the traditional crop for fiber were the cannabis sativa that grew very tall and very spindly, correct? So you have lots of fiber there.
Yeah, and it's not the same thing because those plants, you know, the Christmas trees, you know, there's a lot of branching on them. And, you know, but if you think of bamboo as an example, another fiber crop, that, you know, there's not a lot of branching on it. The, you know, the leaf structure is at the top of the plant to catch the sun. So the crops that we're growing, we're, you know, we don't want any branches. It's going to be a tight seed set. It's going to be, you know, there's not going to be a lot of room in the plants. It's out of the ground very, very fast, kind of like Jack and the Beanstalk type of stuff. And so you don't have to worry too much about herbicides because you're going to create a canopy before the weeds are allowed to even have a chance to get started. And so they grow very quickly. Some of the varieties can reach 20 feet in 80 days.
Do those long spindly stalks contain a lot of herds as well?
Yes. And so the outside is bast fiber. Some people call it bast, some people call it fiber, some people call it both, but it's a fibrous outside. It's the strongest fiber of any plant on the planet. And it's unbelievable tensile strength. And what makes it such a long wearing textile for clothing. And it's also used, you can use it in electronics it's an excellent conductor of electricity when it's treated correctly. And then the inner part, the herd, H-U-R-D, is there's lignin, hemicellulose, cellulose in it, depending on, you know, when you harvested and the variety you grew. But it's called a woody center. And that's the part that has, I mean, both of those items are magical depending on how you finish them. And so you kind of have to begin with the end in mind. So we've accepted a contract for a group that's making bioplastics. Supposedly they're going to be, you know, making, pitching a product to a very well-known toy manufacturer. So we take the herd and we grind it into a talcum powder, you know, the very fine particle size, and that goes into making biodegradable plastics or biodegradable water bottles. This is what the beauty of the hemp plant is. We can replace plastics with it that biodegrade.
It's interesting to note, too, that the phthalates in plastic, like water jugs and whatnot, is now being traced to the infertility in the male of the species. So when you talk about making plastic water glasses out of hemp, would it contain those same chemicals that are in plastic water glasses?
And I'm going to admit to being out over my skis on this, but what they do is the fiber, you replace a petroleum resin with a hemp-based resin. And that is, and depending on the other ingredients that are used, you make PLA or HTPE or, you know, the different types of plastic. But you're eliminating the petroleum resin in the creation of a truly biodegradable plastic. So the gold standard is if that plastic bottle or that plastic lid or whatever ended up in the ocean, would it survive? And the answer is no. It will degrade before it gets there. Or if you just put it in the backyard compost pile, it will break down on its own without sunlight or anything else. And it's this micronized herd is what they call it, is what is just in soaring demand right now. And a farmer can make very good money doing it.
Wow. You know, before we go any further, it seems to me like you're talking about a lot of products that are going to threaten a lot of economic interests.
Yeah, but it's the, you know, the market is changing too. Like, for instance, you know, lumber prices are sky high right now, and it's making, you know, the price of home ownership be out of reach for many. So you see the evolution of the modular home market or the factory home market. Now, the factory homes are looking at a way to cut costs, and so we come along with a panel that's made from hemp.
So we can actually replacing the plastic and fiberglass materials that they're using today, you could make them out of hemp.
Yeah, and also engineered wood products like oriented strand board, OSB. And you can make, there's hemp fiber insulation as the same, R value as the pink insulation we're all used to seeing. You can make, the hemp panels. I was talking to a major home buyer or home builder, just before this show, and, talking about, how many hemp panels can you make, per day, per week, per month? And it's like, well, what thickness do you need, et cetera, et cetera. So, and because we don't have to wait for a forest to grow, like I said, we can grow a crop to maturity in 120 days and then, turn it into a product in 125 days. So seed to solution is the turnaround time is very, very fast. And in California, we can do two crops a year. So I wouldn't even dream of saying we're competing with the wood industry. We are replacing polluting plastics and which is very much needed. So it's really exciting in that respect, that it's, the market is coming our way and we're not trying to build, trying to go out and overtly replace, cotton or wood or petroleum based plastics.
But you can.
We are, and so
you are threatening to economic. The reason I bring that up is because I've heard that one of the major reasons that cannabis was, we instituted prohibition against cannabis, was because of those who were relying on forests. I think it was William Randolph Hearst who was really behind the prohibition of cannabis, and it was because he owned forests or something like that. Maybe I'm off base there, but instead of printing on, wood pulp paper, it could have been printing on cannabis, and the forests would not have been needed to the extent that they are. And another interesting one was Henry Ford. I understand that there was a video or an old movie of him beating on a car made from hemp with a sledgehammer.
Right. Yeah, and this is a very exciting market, Michael, because the fibrous outer side or outer portion of the plant is when you. You carbonize it and you can, in high heat, low temperatures, torrefaction or pyrolysis. And then you can mold this into a very an unbelievably strong and lightweight material. And that's what's so cool about this is that, so you look at people and say, well, I've got this idea. I mean, like Elon Musk and Tesla, so we could make a, components for the car that are lighter weight than what he's currently using. And I'm out over my skis here, but our whole value proposition is to be able to grow in commercial quantities on a reliable basis and match it with third party processing technology that can make a product for automobiles, that can make sound panels that go in, today sound panels are going into BMWs and other German cars that are made from hemp. And the sports car enthusiast from Florida has contacted me and say, can we make carbonized hemp fiber? And it's so exciting what is possible with it. And they just need, acreage and the money to do it.
And you need, when you're thinking in those directions, you have to think about airplanes.
For example, this composite manufacturer, they're in the aerospace industry, and they want to use hemp fiber because of the tensile strength. And so, they were explaining how a composite on an airplane wing worked. and that when it, you know, it flexes down, it compresses the panel on the bottom, and when it, you know, goes up, it compresses on the top. That's why, well, he was trying to explain, and I was, you know, I tried to keep up. But they want to use the hemp fiber to create the superior tensile strength, you know, in like airplane wings or, you know, boards or, you know, building products and so on. And it's, it really is, you know, they, you know, the supply of the product has never been there. And that's what the, that's where the opportunity is now. And that's what we're doing down in, you know, outside of Bakersfield. You know, we're just going to grow tens of thousands of acres with it in rotation with food crops and, you know, potatoes, carrots, that type of thing, root vegetables. And because it, it also suppresses nematodes. And when you grow a food crop in rotation with hemp, you get a superior crop, quality and yield. And so it's, it really is a welcome rotation crop.
So in a very real sense, you are reintegrating cannabis, which was once was one of our principal economic crops, probably throughout our entire history on Earth. You are actually reintegrating that back into our economies where it should be and should have been all along. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Mike Keller, who is the managing partner from New Progress Farms out there in the San Joaquin Valley, the Bakersfield area, going to be planting hemp and growing all kinds of interesting things from it. Things that you and I can use, like airplanes, right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best Liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
Well, it seems very strange indeed that we would use a plant that has been prohibited for the best part of the last century, and in fact is still illegal throughout the United States. And bringing that plant back into uses that, gosh, it could have been using all along, but we turned away from it in favor of its intoxicating properties and prohibited its use. But now to heck with it, we all think. Pretty much all of us were fed up with this whole notion of prohibition. It's time to look at the other uses of this cannabis plant and get it has all kinds of things in it that we can get excited about, other than its intoxicating properties. Has anybody ever sat down and cataloged all of the potential uses of this plant, Mike?
I'm told that there's 50,000 uses, which means suggests somebody sat down and figured it all out. And you know, 50,000, I own. And, you know, 20,000, yeah, I believe 20,000 for sure. But it's such an amazing plant that the biggest problem with its, you know, the becoming more popular, there's no processing centers for it. Grapes have wineries, you know, corn has, you know, grain bins, and you know, flour has bakeries. But there's just this dearth of processing facilities, and so a lot of these guys that are growing it to make consumer products out of it, or ingredients for consumer products, you know, there's no place to process it, to turn it into a product, and they're chasing capital.
That seems to be the big problem that I have seen. Lots of good ideas, but how do we go about reintegrating it when we do not really have the infrastructure for reintegrating it? So where do we start? I guess we got to get some money.
Well, And fortunately, there's, you know, because of the carbon sequestration capability of the crop.
Oh, this is interesting. Okay.
So the you know, the carbon. I mean, a lot of people, you know, they're greenwashing the crop, and they're overstating what it can do. But it can sequester more carbon than I think virtually any other crop that's out there.
How do you, explain that? Okay.
I mean, photosynthesis, so the sun, you know, comes down and it absorbs CO2 and releases oxygen. And so a crop that it grows, for every pound of hemp that you grow, it will store 1.63 pounds of CO2 in it. And so governments are, you know, like the Exxon thing last week, that, you know, that they were held accountable for climate change because of carbon emissions. So now they're looking at hemp as an offset for their petroleum emissions.
So theoretically, see if I'm off base here. Say you're a famous movie star, and you have a penchant for ending climate change, and you get in your Gulfstream G5 and you fly around the world to Helsinki for a climate conference. Mm-hmm. Well, you've just burned up a lot of jet fuel and you've released a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. But you can say, look, ladies and gentlemen, I just bought some carbon credits from this farm in Bakersfield, California, that's mm-hmm. growing hemp, industrial hemp.
Yeah.
And they sequestered all this carbon for me, and I bought the credits for that, so I'm okay. And there's your source of money.
Yeah. And you know, Tesla did that. You know, they sold carbon credits, which, you know, accounted for, you know, financing their operations in the later years, because they were not burning fossil fuels to power their automobiles. Now, and you start getting into embodied carbon. You know, how much carbon did it take to make the building that we're sitting in right now? And, you know, regardless of whether it's on solar or wind power or whatever, you know, there's still embodied carbon to make it. So this whole, I mean, it's like, extremism in environmentalism, in carbon emissions. I shouldn't say environmentalism, but people tracking down your carbon footprint to degrees that would astound you. They astound me. But they come to me and say, we will pay you X amount of dollars per acre for hemp for the carbon credits. And there's 61 different carbon credit exchanges in the world today. And because the United States, rejoined the Paris Accord, and now and it just is just like, holy cow, now it's the golden ball game. There are trillions of dollars chasing after carbon credits now. And I talked to a money manager today out of New York, Peter Fusaro, and it's astounding the amount of money that people are paying to avoid carbon or to take carbon out of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. So then we have a source of money. Okay.
Yes.
Let's fill our imaginary pockets with this carbon credit money. And then what do we do? We have money. What do we do now?
You put in, you can grow it, but you've got to add value to it after you grow it. And so what New Progress is doing is we're focused on being able to make a low carbon, or I used to say zero carbon, but it's a low carbon net zero energy home that's affordable and sustainable. So to live with the effects of climate change, you can argue about the causes of climate change, but you can't argue with what's going on right now. Temperatures, extreme weather events, hot, cold, dry, wet, you name it. And so you need a home that's going to be better suited to withstand these temperatures, and a home made of hemp is exactly what that does.
Wait a minute. Just a second now. What you're telling us is that the New Progress Farm is going to be growing houses.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. And, the technology is there. The demand is there. Everything is there, it's better for the planet in so many different ways. It improves food yield, it reduces the use of soil-borne diseases. It sequesters carbon. You can have a more comfortable home. It's like walking into, a cave, or you're down in a basement where there's the air is just different. And in a hemp home, a home that's made from hemp, has breathable walls. You don't have mold. You don't have, there's so many different benefits to it, but it's kind of like Grand Earth homes or, some of these other, the hippie homes of the 70s. But now these are beautiful homes that would, belong on the most, the most toniest street in town. And you would no longer be able to tell the difference. It was hemp or wood based.
And so you can use the hemp to make wood replacement products. You can use the hemp to make hempcrete or concrete products too, right?
And then you can also,
as Henry Ford taught us so long ago, you can actually make a replacement for metal.
That's right. 50,000 uses, that's a lot of uses, and it covers just about every aspect of, of the civilized world. And it is a miraculous plant, and I'm just so grateful that we're able to see it, the prohibition being lifted on it, and now the technologies are coming out of the woodwork, so to speak, to turn it into a value-added product that, makes for better living.
And so a lot of companies are actually developing the processes to do these things.
Yeah. And Patagonia or Levi's, both of those companies, just to name two, are reportedly bringing out products that are, comprised, more like they're a hemp cotton blend that will last longer than a straight cotton or a denim product. And the, Patagonia, the leader in, environmental stewardship, shall we say, and they love the idea of bringing hemp back to North America and no longer sourcing it from China, which is, you know, there's questionable growing practices there. And, you know, but you don't have the carbon footprint of shipping it, you know, on bunker fuel in a freighter from China to San Francisco and then processing it here. So it's really upsetting the world's trade by being able to repatriate, if you will, a lot of these products that are, you know, no longer being made offshore, but made here that are making a better product or a better living for the farmer. There's so many ways to win. It's almost like, you know, an ad campaign that somebody dreamed up. You know, it's almost too good to be true.
It's too good to be true. And but the promise is there. The plant is a miracle in itself. And there's been a good and faithful servant throughout time. From the very beginning, it's been with us and taking good care of us. And now perhaps we can refocus on many of those things that we've been ignoring through prohibition and use them to make a better world for ourselves. Now, when you say you're going to be growing homes on your farm, so you're going to be growing the plant, you're going to be taking the plant and then processing the various parts of that plant into various building materials, correct?
That's right.
So are you going to build a factory of some kind?
Yes. And it's, you know, like I said, we need a processing center. And because of the acreage that we have access to, we can repurpose, a brownfield site, let's say, and, you know, where there's an existing building, and we'll bring in. So you have to have a decorticator to basically strip the fiber off the plant, and then grind the herd, and then, you know, you process the fiber until it becomes, you know, what you want it to be, whether it's a non-woven textile like felt, or you can have, you know, where it's a fine, you know, fine fiber like for a shirt or a garment of some sort, and seed haulers and that thing to make, you know, to go into food products or just to sell on their own. You can buy them at grocery stores around town, you know, hemp hearts.
Now, are some of these processes, I'm sure, dated back to before Prohibition as well, were they not?
It's kind of crude, but because machinery and design has advanced.
Right.
And now, you know, there's this fascinating, you know, rate of technological innovation. You know, the decorticators, for example, there's different ways that people are coming up to do it. There's, you know, where they strip it off. Other people are flattening the stock and then stripping it off. There's a gentleman that we're in business with. He makes a ribbon decorticator. It's it makes for a very long fiber and very high quality fiber that would be good in making graphene or, you know, plant-based batteries and that type of thing. It's the value add use it as a base product and you apply a technology to it. Let's say pyrolysis, high temperature, low oxygen, turns it into this material that makes carbon nanotubes out of the fiber. It's almost like, you know, stop, I can't take anymore. Come back tomorrow, we'll resume the discussion.
And yet it's there.
Yeah, and so for the farmer, for what we're doing, we're trying to figure out which market is the best, is, you know, where we can, you know, we can do the most good, we can make the most money, honestly, and then invest in that equipment to process it, and there you go.
There you go. So got to get the equipment. But, you know, the funding mechanism is there. The technology has been there forever. And when you take that ancient technology and apply modern machinery and know-how, make it a lot easier. So the money's there, the technology is there, and the plant is there. And the plant has always been there. So, goodness sakes, this pretty promising future for the cannabis plant.
Yeah, just in closing, Michael, you know, we've got, you know, the political will is there too, and foundation money is there as well. That people that, you know, hippies with money, I call them, they want to save the world, and they're not interested in a return on their capital. They just want to see the world survive, and it's just, you know, like it's a perfect storm, if you will, for hemp, and the rebirth of the hemp industry in North America.
Well, Mike Keller, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, mkeller at newprogressfarms.com, or I'm on LinkedIn. Our website isn't up yet, but Michael Keller on LinkedIn and our New Progress Farms. So
there you go.
I'm happy to get my phone number, too, if you want me to say it.
So, just Mike Keller, K-E-L-L-E-R. And they'll track you down because we're all trackable down now. Mike, thank you for joining us. And ladies and gentlemen, remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Just think of it. Cannabis-built sandcastles. I'm for it. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks so much, Michael. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.